Good morning. This is Lisa Schroff, and I want to thank you for joining me on this Tuesday, April 29th of 2025. Before I begin my comments, I want to remind you that any recommendations that I make on this call can be accessed by either emailing us or giving us a call. Also, I want to mention that if you could mute your lines when we do the Q&A, which is pressing *41, I believe, *41, so that we don't hear your office background noise. Thank you, unless you can ask a question, which is *42. Okay, I want to talk a little bit. I guess, you know, one of the themes I wanted to talk about for several weeks, but I don't think I've really touched on it too much, and I kind of want to reiterate it because there have been a lot of articles out touching on that, and you just haven't seen that until this year, and it is about illiquidity, and especially in the investment class of what's called private equity. And boy, has that not been a combined word, private equity equals illiquidity, until lately. It has been an area of investment that has produced excellent returns over a few decades, generally speaking. And the reason is what private equity is a fund that typically borrows a lot of money, buys companies, and then eventually resells them or has them go public. And the idea is that the investors in the fund get paid out early because the money's been borrowed. And so they basically leverage up the companies and resell them. And so it isn't, as I've often said, it's kind of financial engineering. Everybody says it has been such a great place to invest. The reality of it is when you can borrow money at cheap rates and pay out your investors dividends through that, why not, right? And it creates a compounded effect in terms of total return. Just, it's much like buying a house. You know, you get a mortgage, and when you sell it, you have, in a way, a stronger return because you really borrowed a lot of that money. Same thing is true with private equity and, frankly, any private investments. We could say that about private credit or, you know, real estate, commercial real estate. And these are all areas that have historically been the arena of institutional investors. In other words, pension funds and large funds that have invested because these are either, one, high net worth individuals or primarily institutions such as pensions and endowments that have long-term outlooks. They've got a lot of cushion so they can take risk, and they've got very long-term outlooks because these kinds of, quote, private investments are typically tied up for a matter of years. That's the agreement. When investors agree to go into these funds, they say, well, you're not going to get your money back for at least 5 years and maybe longer, 10 years. And that's the agreement. But what's been happening lately, as some of these funds come to their, quote, end of life, let's say 5 or 10 years, they're supposed to have sold the companies or cashed out on whatever it is, and return the investment, the original investment, to the investor, and then they go into new funds. So there's always something coming up that's coming to what's called maturity and rolling it over. But what has happened in the last several months, and frankly even before the elections, is that with rising interest rates, it's been harder to sell companies in the markets. It's been harder to take companies public. You'll see that the IPO numbers are down from their peaks, and this has been going on for a couple of years, and so that the liquidity is freezing up. And I just want to mention this because you're starting to see titles out there that are kind of eye-catching, and I'll give you an example. Last Tuesday, a week ago, there was a title in Pension and Investments magazine titled Yale University Studying Sale of Private Equity Holdings on the Secondary Market. Now, Yale University, of all endowment funds in the United States, has been on the forefront of private equity. They actually kind of started the trend many, many, many years ago. And they have a large amount of their funds invested in private equity, which are, you know, long-held assets. And for Yale University to be, quote, studying the sale of private equity holdings on the secondary market means, one, there is no easy exit strategy right now. And two, they need the money. And so the third thing you can probably deduct from all of these funds starting to look at the, quote, secondary market, seeing if somebody will take these investments off their hands, is that they will go at a big discount. Because basically new funds have been developed to take these funds that haven't come to fruition off their hands. And so they have to go at a big discount. So you're starting to see, and maybe it's not a trend, but if it is a trend, watch out. You're starting to see the unraveling of what I call the leverage investment environment that really worked during declining interest rates. It really worked since the early 80s, which is when Yale started doing this. And you're starting to see articles come out talking about illiquidity in these private investment funds. I think there was an article in the Wall Street Journal. In fact, it was a week and a half ago, titled "Slump Threatens Private Equity Cash Machine." And the inset of it says, "The lack of deals makes it harder for firms to return money to clients." And I've always said that, you know, there is something out there in the downturn that, you know, gets hit. In 2007, it was mortgage-backed securities, you know, all the leveraged loans, right? And it really hit the banks. Well, this time around, I really believe the problems are going to be centered on these leveraged funds that are often invested in by our pensions and by our endowments, especially our university endowments, the institutional investors. And I just think that this is an early story, and I think that if there is a big problem in the markets, which there could very well be, I think it's really kind of, you're going to be reading more about this. And I guess I could say for once, although it's bittersweet, that the stock market is a liquid machine. You know, you may sell it at a big discount if you want to get rid of the stock, but you can sell it today and have it clear in a day or two. So there's a difference there. But, you know, maybe this time around the damage will be elsewhere and not in the stock market. Having said that, I believe that the S&P 500 is overpriced, still trading at 21 times estimated 2025 earnings. You know, this year, I've talked about this a lot too, we've started to see that there's been a rotation where the large cap growth stocks, which had led the markets up for the past several years, have led the markets down. However, competing headlines. I think it was in Barron's, but there was a title that said something like, Mag 7 stocks recover almost all of their April declines. And this was, I think, an article on Friday. Or stocks claw back most of April's declines. And I do think if there is a decline in the general market, it really hasn't. I think most investors are pretty complacent, especially with the stocks that have worked for them, the investments that have worked for them for decades, which is, again, private equity outside of the traded stock market. It's, again, in growth stocks. But I do see a lot of complacency, and you really won't see a wholesale change in rotation or long-term change in rotation or general S&P 500 decline relative to other things out there until investors really begin to capitulate and say, wow, what's been working isn't working, and I got to do something different. And I honestly don't think you're really seeing that much. People are talking about it, but you're really not seeing it much. But I actually am really looking forward to that opportunity. We've already seen some of it. Certainly our portfolios are non-correlated to the S&P 500, and it's certainly helped our results this year, very much so. But I think you're going to see a lot more of it in the next year or two. And so it's an environment, maybe in a way bittersweet, but I am looking forward to. Okay, want to talk a little bit about companies. This is reporting season where companies are reporting their first quarter results for 2025, and I'm just going to give you a few highlights. One is in the area of tariffs, which is, you know, kind of the headline. A lot of companies, even if their earnings are good, if they get hurt by tariffs, the stock might have declined during the earnings call because they talked about how they're concerned about how tariffs might hurt the rest of the year earnings, things like that. And I'm, the one company I'm talking about in specific as it regards to this is Alcoa. Alcoa reported better than expected earnings. In fact, on an operating basis for the first quarter, Alcoa Aluminum Company reported $2.15 a share versus a loss a year ago. So strong improvement. But in their comments, they said that they do see that the tariffs kicking in is going to start to hurt their results. They said in the first quarter, the stronger aluminum market really led to better results, but they do see the a tariff environment starting to hurt results in the coming quarters. A lot of their aluminum that comes into the United States, that the aluminum, they have plants all over the world, but the aluminum that comes into the United States is primarily actually manufactured in Canada. I'll just give you an example. The company's estimates, this is only a $25 stock, by the way, now, but the estimates for 2025 prior to their earnings report a week ago were $4 a share for 2025. Again, this is a $25 stock. And now, after the earnings report, analysts lowered their estimates, so the average earnings estimate for 2025 is now $3.56. So, you know, investors, given the guidance, are expecting poorer results than expected in the following three quarters. Nevertheless, I do think the tariff situation, one way or the other, is going to be resolved. And I do think Alcoa down here is a very good value. Trust me, nobody's going into the aluminum business these days. It is, you know, it's too expensive to start. And one of the things that the management said on their call is that you know, the Chinese have always kind of tried to undercut everybody. But here's an interesting statistic. 80% of the Chinese smelters that are currently operating are unprofitable. And there is some belief by at least Alcoa management that they might start to cut back on some of this unprofitable production in China, which would leave more room for everybody else. We'll see. But anyway, I do think Alcoa here, I think it's cheap. We continue to hold Alcoa. Also wanted to mention Newmont Mining. The company reported a strong operational performance. Newmont Mining is primarily a gold mining company, and the company reported $1.25 in operating earnings for the quarter, and that's pretty good. I mean, this is a $53 stock, so if you multiplied that by four, you'd have earnings of $5 a share. This is a $53 stock. Trust me, nobody really believes that gold is going to go higher from here or even hold up here, but the company had quite good results. They reduced their debt by $1 billion because they've been selling some assets that are non-core. They did realize about $2,944 per ounce in realized gold in the first quarter. And again, you know, when I look at gold today, it's down. It's down about $25 an ounce, but it's trading around $3,300 an ounce. That's even higher than the average for the first quarter of $2,944 an ounce. So, you know, I do think 2025 is going to be a good year. Average estimates right now for 2025 are for the company on an operating basis to earn $4.31 a share. And, you know, again, this is a $53 stock. We think it's very reasonably priced. And I think the gold and silver companies will have a pretty good year this year. Also wanted to mention just a touch on to get back to Alcoa, just in general, as I've talked about, we're really pretty bullish on natural gas. Not just pretty, we're bullish on natural gas. And I've talked about that in past calls. And, you know, something came out in the country of Spain. I don't know if those of you on the call read this, but the country of Spain yesterday had a blackout. Almost the whole country had a blackout. And they had a problem with their electricity power infrastructure. And it was, in a way, ironic because just 4 days ago, or 5 days ago now, the country's regulatory authorities had kind of bragged, frankly, that they had their first day ever of operating on all renewable resources in the country of Spain. And that would also include hydro, but it includes, of course, wind and solar. And they kind of bragged about it a little bit. Well, 5 days later, they have a full-on country blackout and for their electricity. And all the airports stopped, everything stopped, including, by the way, Alcoa's Ciprion aluminum mine, or aluminum facility. Alcoa's facility actually also had to shut down. And the point I'm making is I do think as we start to get into, you know, just the realities of the needing baseload, I do think natural gas is coming back into favor. You know, there had been a period where we've got to do as much renewables as possible. But what all these countries, including Germany with no wind, are finding out is you can't have consistent manufacturing if you're going to rely on electric power that is intermittent, such as wind and solar. And I do think natural gas is coming back into being popular as a solution. And I think it's actually starting to reflect that. I looked at where the price of natural gas is. I think we've gone to the next month's contracts. I'll use yesterday's prices, not today's prices, but as because the price of natural gas today is even higher. And it doesn't really show that there's a big jump. But let's just talk about yesterday's natural gas contract price. Yesterday's natural contract price is up about 60% from a year ago. Yesterday's natural gas contract price is up about 30% from 2 years ago. It's up about 80% versus 5 years ago and up about 20% versus 10 years ago. It's actually down about 50% from 20 years ago. But 20 years ago, as an example, San Juan Basin Royalty Trust, which has had a nice move, but it's trading around $6 a share, 20 years ago, San Juan Basin Royalty Trust was trading at $31 a share. 10 years ago, when the price of natural gas was lower than where it is today, San Juan Basin Royalty Trust was trading at $11 a share, and it's a $6 a stock. And the point I'm making is I think there is so much room for these natural gas stocks to run. This company in particular is actually not even a company. It's a royalty trust. And when the company has good cash flow, they pay out dividends to the shareholders of this royalty trust. And one of the reasons it's been depressed is they have not been paying out dividends because we had had a very depressed price of natural gas. But that has been turning. And I do think we might start to see dividends in the latter half of 2025 for San Juan Basin Royalty Trust. And when that happens, I think the stock is actually going to even go higher. I think longer term, this stock has a chance to, from here, double or more. I'm pretty excited about this whole space of natural gas. We also own another direct natural gas producer, which is Range Resources, and we also own in the portfolio a drilling equipment company for oil and natural gas, which is Innovex, which has been a pretty depressed stock, but is a financially very strong company. And I do think that stock will come around as well. Okay, also kind of wanted to mention, just as it stands, there was an article in yesterday's paper that highlighted that longtime investor, John Paulson. And for those of you that have been around a while, you might recall that I believe his firm, John Paulson's firm, was maybe Paulson Capital Management, but he was a big hedge fund manager back in the 2000s. And you might recall that he was kind of one of the biggest winners out of the great financial crisis, his firm was. They, I believe, shorted mortgage-backed securities, and they had something like a $14 billion windfall. Actually was a $15 billion windfall back in 2007. And So with those proceeds, what he did is in 2008 is he invested in gold, in primarily gold. And the gist of this article is that it took, more than a decade and a half to reap the rewards. I mean, you know, it's a long time in the investment world, right? How many people sit around with an investment for 15 years? In fact, I will tell you, if you do that, your clients will eventually leave you. And in fact, John Paulson, the fund manager, eventually shut down, and now the money he runs or manages is really just his own family money. But the point I'm making is that investment finally paid off, and there's an article that talks about that, and that he's reaped with these gold investments that he made back in 2008. He's finally reaping the rewards, and he's had quite a windfall. The article also goes on to talk about that he's not just selling. In fact, he's buying more. He has agreed to invest in a gold mine in Alaska and putting in another $800 million along with a gold mining company to run a gold mine up in Alaska. And so there have been a lot of articles talking about is this time different? Could gold actually stay up here and even go higher? It's very possible if we have some kind of a regime change in monetary policy and currency reserve, it's very possible that gold goes higher, and I think it will. But this guy, John Paulson, believes that is the story going forward and is actually putting even more money into that space. But the other theme that I wanted to mention that just comes out of this article is that a lot of really great investors in time do what I call, I guess they're called fat pitches, where you go all in on something, but it may take years and years and years for it to come to fruition. In fact, you know, Warren Buffett has been known for that. He can go years on end with underperforming the markets, and then voila, 7 or 10 years later or longer, that his investments pay off. And it isn't very many, especially professional money managers, that have that ability because their clients are so short-term oriented. You won't have any clients if you have to wait around 10 years for an investment to take off. And I think Warren Buffett would be the first to tell you that because he doesn't have clients. He has a company that they use their own cash to make investments. Anyway, the point I'm making is it's just another lesson that sometimes doing things different, if you've got the patience, can really, really pay off. Okay, I think, let me just double check here to see that I've made all the comments I want to. There were a lot of earnings reports this week, and I think I've pretty much covered, unless you want to ask about them, what I wanted to. Just one other company, Hecla Mining. The stock had a little bounce last week because with a new measure that was been put out there by the current White House administration, that I don't know the name of the measure, you know, it's like a bill out there, but it's to increase American mineral production. Hecla Mining has been fast track on a new mine that they want to open in North America, and so the stock got a little bit of a bounce out of that. Okay, with that, Alaska Airlines. I just wanted to mention that briefly. Alaska Airlines, as you know, we sold a little bit of it a month or so ago. The stock has had a nice bounce. Now the stock is down. It's not down to where we originally purchased it, but it is disappointing. Maybe we should have sold the whole thing if we were short-term oriented, but we're not. We think that the stock will go quite a bit higher over time because we think the acquisition of Hawaiian Airlines is a good one. But I wanted to mention that they reported last week, and they reported a loss, which they usually do in the first quarter because it's a very seasonal business for them, travel, especially to Alaska. But they did report a larger loss than earlier estimated at 77 cents a share, and the estimates had been around 50 to 70 cents a share. But they did talk in the conference call about, quote, demand softness. No big surprise there with the tariffs. All the airlines are coming out and either dropping their guidance for the year or talking about a softer year than expected, and that's no different with Alaska Airlines. But the company did say that their merger with Hawaiian is going very well, and everything is working, quote, except for the macro environment, which has slowed. And somebody asked them about, what about that $10 a share estimate that you thought you could do for earnings in 2027? And the company basically didn't, I don't think they really answered the question, but they basically said it's due to their synergies that they made that estimate for, you know, basically 3 years out at the time, 3 or 4 years out at the time. But earnings estimates have been shaved pretty dramatically. In 2025, analysts had been looking for $6, over $6 a share in earnings. And now, after this earnings release, they're looking for $3.87 a share for 2025. So estimates in the short term certainly are being cut due to the macro environment. Our reason for holding still our two-thirds position of Alaska Airlines is we think it's a great acquisition they made with Hawaiian Airlines, and we think the synergies between the two companies are going to be excellent, and you will start to see that in coming years. Okay, with that, I'm going to go ahead and open it up for questions, and I'm going to unmute the lines. Okay, are there any questions this morning?
Lisa, where does Black Hills Energy or Natural Gas, is that still in a good buy range, or what, how do you?
Well, all the, yeah, good question. The question's on Black Hills Power, which is an electric utility, and the stock has moved up. I mean, not in the last month, but it's moved up from where it was trading, let's say about, it's definitely moved up from where it was trading at 9 months ago, you know, and so it's had a nice move. And the utilities, generally speaking, 9 months ago were kind of out of favor, and they've just, you know, all moved up. But they haven't really done much in general, I would say, for the past, you know, 3 months. They've been pretty flat, including Black Hills. Yes, absolutely, Black Hills plays into our natural gas theme. Both Black Hills and Northwestern Energy have an abundance of natural gas, and they both operate in areas that have an abundance of natural gas and also coal. It's low sulfur coal, which has been much maligned, but it is a base load, and there are technologies that really clean that coal. And I will say, you know, the reality of it is because of regulations, all electric utilities are, you know, kind of phasing out coal, even though they're sad about it because it's a nice and trusty base load for electric utilities. And the same is true for Black Hills Corp and Northwestern Energy. But they both are big on natural gas because of where they operate, which is North Dakota, South Dakota, Wyoming, Montana, those areas. And you can imagine how they are strong in natural resources. And so one of the reasons why the data centers are looking to this area to put in data centers is because of the cheap power. And both Black Hills and Northwestern Energy, which are two utilities that we own, two out of three we own, would be beneficiaries of that. So, yes, it is, in a way, a play on natural gas. Any other questions? Okay. With that, I'm going to go ahead and end the call. I want to thank you for joining me today, and I will be back in 2 weeks.